This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's our weekly Reporters Roundtable conversation we have with the local members of the media that have contributed stories online and in print. We have today Mark Chase, who is the investigative editor and a member of the editorial board of the Times of Northwest Indiana, along with Carmen McCollum, who covers educational stories for the Times. Also joining us today, we'll have Joseph Pete, who covers business news for the Times and also from the Times of Northwest Indiana, and Ruth Steele, who covers some business news as well as transportation issues for the Times. Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. It's from the opportunity we have to talk with members of the Northwest Indiana media about the stories that they have covered, not only in print for their newspapers, but online as well, too, on their websites. And we have a number of reporters from the Times of Northwest Indiana that we've lined up with a conversation today. And let's first start off here with one of the editors, as well as an investigative reporter. Mark Chase is with us. Mark, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, Chris, how are you?
Fine, thank you. In recent weeks, you've had various articles and columns that have come out, not only on the editorial page, but also elsewhere in the newspaper, talking about the state of the, I guess, the Northwest Indiana political atmosphere in light of the conviction by a federal court jury of former Sheriff John Buntzich. Sheriff Buntzich is going to be appearing before the judge once again very soon for his sentencing on the charges that the jury had passed down in their verdict against him. And you're still concerned very much about what some of the comments may come about from some of the people who have an opportunity to comment one way or the other about about Sheriff Buntzich and his time in office and I guess and maybe not necessarily the charges that he's been convicted of, but certainly I guess his political legacy, aren't you?
Sure. No, absolutely. And I mean, look, we've had a culture, and people are very well aware of it around who have been here for any amount of time. We have a culture of political corruption in Northwest Indiana that has obviously been propped up quite well over the years, despite, you know, more than 80 people being convicted of crimes against the public in federal court since probably the mid-80s. We still continue to see public officials, oftentimes elected public officials, go down to these types of convictions. And Sheriff John Buntzich is one of the more recent ones, one of the more high-ranking ones that we've seen in quite some time. The whole notion of my recent columns is to basically point out this culture that keeps seeming to perpetuate itself around here, and to promise that anybody that files letters in the court that would call for leniency or be supportive of the sheriff, the former sheriff, I might add, now a convicted felon, that if they're sitting a public official or community leader, we're gonna publish their names and let people know what they've said about the individual.
I know that you used in your most recent article here a case study here about one recent incident which has come to light, a case that has come up with a grand jury indictment, but not yet gone before the judge on the charges here, about a former member of the Maryville Town Council.
Yeah, and my whole point there was to say, hey, there were warning signs about him before he, of course, the Maryville Town Councilman is Tom Goralchik. He recently was indicted and pleaded guilty at the same time of similar towing bribery charges that the sheriff pleaded guilty to, that the sheriff was convicted of. Mm-hmm. And I was pointing out that there were some warning signs early on. It was a few years ago when we had the big controversy with the designer purse. That Jeff Langman, the former executive director of the Solid Waste District, was purchasing. He purchased this designer purse and accessories as a gift for one of his female subordinates in his office, and he purchased it on the government a government credit card. Taxpayers paid for it. It was an unauthorized purchase. When the board finally found out what he'd actually done, it ultimately led to his firing. But in an executive session before they fired Langman, Tom Goralchik walked into that meeting with a designer purse and accessories and tried to make a case for why this was an acceptable purchase and use of taxpayer dollars, which, of course, everybody else in the room, thankfully, thought otherwise. But here he was being an apologist for this type of behavior. I think some of that apologist-type mentality can be seen in these letters of leniency that people file in the court after public officials have been convicted of crimes against the taxpayer.
Is it of your opinion, and certainly because you've been an observer as well as your own personal opinion as well that you've stated in your columns, do you think that this is kind of a situation because it's been a longstanding acceptance that certain practices apparently may not seem to be against the law, but they actually are because there are laws, there are statutes that state so. Do you think it's just something that people have come to accept as a given here in Northwest Indiana, to be sure?
Well, to a degree, I think some of that's true. A lot of these people that have been convicted, George Van Til from a number of years ago, Lake County Surveyor, his was the first case when I actually wrote about people that were writing into the court on his behalf. Why are these sitting public officials, and there were many of them, elected officials that wrote letters on his behalf seeking leniency ahead of his sentence, why are they carrying water for somebody that's been convicted of crimes against essentially stealing from the taxpayer? And I remember back then, George would tell us ahead of his case, hey, I didn't know this was wrong, or how was I supposed to know? Everybody else did this stuff. And I think that's kind of the mentality. Everybody else has done it, and so why can't I?
Mm-hmm. From what you could tell from the research that you've done, how far back would you say this is probably gone?
Well, I mean, you know, the cases I'm familiar with and the convictions we've tracked out of federal court go back to the mid-'80s, and they all seem to have a similar M.O., you know, mm-hmm. and it all seems to be part of a similar cycle and even a culture of corruption.
Now, obviously, in the years since Jeff Langman has left office, his particular post with the Solid Waste Management District, there have been some improvements made. And do you think that the things in that respect have gone better now because of what had happened?
Sure. And that's the good news. There are examples of things that are being operated in a better government capacity. They cut their spending drastically at the Solid Waste District. I think they got rid of most, if not all, of the government credit cards that they were using to keep better controls on the spending. There are a lot of things that have changed in that regard. They parked all these take-home cars that several employees were driving. You know, the executive director used to get a brand new model vehicle lease of a souped-up SUV every year, and that's gone away. There are certainly fixes there, and you can see it in other elements of government and other entities, too. Mm-hmm. Some individuals that have been convicted of crimes against the taxpayer in the past, you've seen somebody step up who is running a much tighter ship. So even though I talked about the culture, which I think still persists, there are reasons to be hopeful, and there are some examples of people doing what they're supposed to be doing.
Now, in the weeks and the months ahead now, we will no doubt be finding out other charges. Obviously, the sentencing will happen for Mr. Gralchik in time, and he'll come back before federal court after the grand jury handed down the indictment, and he had pled guilty to the charges that were filed in that indictment. Are you going to probably do the same and then stay on top of this? That is to the respect that if there are people at his sentencing that are going to speak out one way or the other, that they'll be held accountable?
Yeah, we will use a similar screen for that. We will incorporate, you know, a similar policy in what we do, for sure.
Mm-hmm. Have you gotten any response, by the way, from folks with the U.S. Attorney's Office about how you stand on this?
Not from the U.S. Attorney's Office. You know, they don't tend to weigh in on these matters. As you know, the federal prosecutors and investigators tend to be pretty tight-lipped about cases, especially when they have pending hearings coming up. We certainly have heard from the local Lake County Bar Association, which isn't pleased about the fact that we've promised to publish the names of apologists for John Buntzich. They think it may impede his ability to get support for leniency ahead of trial or ahead of sentencing. And I really don't buy those arguments. We are not impeding anybody's right to step forward and support whomever they want to support, but they should just know that that's a matter of public record, and they're subject to scrutiny if they do so.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, I know that there were at least a couple attorneys that had said some comments as a result, and I think the Indiana lawyer basically had to feature those comments in the remarks that they had made, I guess, to the newspaper based in Indianapolis. And I was wondering if you've heard back directly from these people as well.
I have not heard directly from anyone. I know our company as a whole has heard from the Bar Association. They've heard from a couple of other lawyers. Buntzich's lawyer, Brian Truitt, took to social media with some screeds about my column after I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
He's never contacted me directly, never asked to talk to me. And that's fine. It doesn't it doesn't really matter. It's not going to change my position. This is a matter of public record, and given the culture that we have around here, I think it's a very important matter of public record.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think that in light of what's about to happen as far as the sentencing is concerned for former Sheriff Buncich and in turn what will happen eventually for former Maryville Town Councilman Grawchuk, that maybe has caused a wake-up call in some respects for people in public office in Northwest Indiana?
Well, we certainly hope so. I mean, we hope that this is having a deterrent effect somewhere, or it's at the very least forcing somebody to question practices or review what they're doing or change their behavior if they are going down this path or have already started down it. That is certainly the biggest hope that these federal indictments and these federal operations to weed this stuff out. You don't want them to just have to keep, arresting these people and sending them to prison for crimes against the taxpayer. At some point, you hope that it has some sort of a deterrent effect.
Mark Chase is a reporter. He's also the investigative editor and the editorial page editor for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Mark, thanks for being with us to talk about this. We'll look forward to when things happen in federal court to the reaction that comes about as well, too. Thanks for being with us to talk about your article.
No problem, Chris. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. Continuing on with Regionally Speaking's Report Roundtable Thursday, let's turn now to Carmen McCollum, who covers education issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And she's calling us from the office over in Crown Point. Carmen, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you. Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Here, as we get started, a number of stories you had in editions in print as well as online this week here, most of them dealing with things that have developed with the Gary Community School Corporation, which we have talked many times before about some of the financial and economic, financial and educational problems with the Gary Community Schools. And the latest involves some personnel issues here. Let's talk first here about some of the concerns that, you know, that you've noted here as well. How the school board is dealing with the changes. They've taken things kind of hard when the state takeover took effect, haven't they?
Yes. The school board members have several questions regarding the takeover. And I have to say that there were several meetings prior to that to explain Senate Bill 567. Mm-hmm. However, there are still questions that the board members have, and so many of them object to it. And, of course, the latest story that came out this week regarding school board president Rosie Washington, who has decided to resign effective December 31st, that will leave 1 year on her years for being on the school
mm-hmm.
board.
Right.
She was scheduled to leave December 31st, 2018, so she'll have 1 year left, and they will have to appoint somebody to her position. I did talk to the other school board members, and none of them, including Nellie Moore, who is in her third term, are planning to resign.
Yeah. So it's just Rosie right now, and we also know too that, and this had been mentioned earlier too, that the Gary Community School Superintendent Cheryl Pruitt is going to step down as well too, and that may be a position that may not be filled for a while. I understand.
Right. Cheryl Pruitt is stepping down effective February 2nd, 2018. When I talked to the emergency manager, Peggy Hinckley, she said that she had conversations with the Distress Unit Appeals Board, and at this point, they don't intend to fill that position. That could change later because, there are many day-to-day responsibilities that have to be done, and that maybe they might need somebody for that. But for now, Peggy Hinckley is the person running the Gary Community School Corporation.
And I know that Dr. Pruitt has been doing her part to at least to kind of be the liaison in the way, I guess, between the public and Gary, as well as the school board with Dr. Hinckley and her staff, who are actually running things on a day-to-day basis, too.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
When you get back to here talking here about the school board vacancy, when Rosie Washington steps down and somebody will have to be chosen, what's the usual procedure in something like that? Because she was serving a position that basically was selected by residents of Gary in an election.
Right.
How's that going to happen as far as filling Rosie's position on the school board?
Now, as far as my understanding is, the Gary School Board, like any other school board, if a vacancy occurred, mm-hmm. people will apply to the Gary School Board to be take over that position, the last year of that position, and they will choose somebody from those people who apply. Now, we don't know if there are any changes because of Senate Bill 567, and nobody from the I was not able to reach anyone from the Distressed Unit Appeals Board. So right now, that is the process of the way it works with most boards, mm-hmm. and then we will have to see if there are any changes at all regarding that.
We're talking with Carmen McCollum, who covers education issues here in Northwest Indiana for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And I know, Carmen, one of the stories that you've had out online as well as in print as well talks about some of the discussion that's come out of Indianapolis with the State Board of Education about graduation rates. There's been some new reports that have come out this week, and there are some concerns, I'm sure, among school board members as well as superintendents in the districts up here in Northwest Indiana about the graduation rates and the impact this is all going to have.
Yeah, they are very concerned, but as you may or may not know, the State Board of Education met yesterday in Indianapolis, and they approved graduation pathways. There are some concerns. In fact, I got a note this morning from it came in last night mm-hmm. from River Forest School Superintendent Steve Disney, who told me that after 7.5 hours of testimonies, the Indiana Superintendents Association, Indiana Principals Association, Indiana Teacher Association, and the Indiana School Boards Association all testified and requested that the graduation pathways be voted no and adjustments be made. However, the State Board of Education passed it 7-4. And Steve says that though there were several people from Northwest Indiana who attended that meeting, and that was Dr. Larry Baracco, mm-hmm. Lake Central Superintendent, Mike Krutz, Maryville High School Principal, John Hunter, Union Township Superintendent, and Stacy Schmidt, Porter County Superintendent, all attended that State Board of Education meeting. I know that they are concerned. I'll be talking to them more. There may be a follow-up story on when it becomes effective and how that's going to affect their districts. And you know that they've all said that their graduation rate is going to go down. Right. In fact, I believe Steve Disney in River Forest said that their rate is about 91% and it may drop. No, 81%, I believe it was. Mm-hmm. And it may drop to 54% with the way the graduation standards are.
That's a pretty big drop, and it's going to be very difficult.
Yeah.
Well, it's understandable why not only superintendents but the school board members and the education associations are very concerned with how the State Board of Education is dealing with this. Are they hoping that maybe that there'll be some reconsideration of this in the future?
I think that they are, but we'll just have to see how all of that works out. Mm-hmm. It's gonna be a very interesting period. I know that the superintendents also talk about the extra work for guidance counselors, some other problems, and special education students may possibly. And when I say special ed students, I mean students who maybe have a resource teacher, who maybe have just a learning disability,
right.
Who may have difficulty in passing some of those tests and making sure that they get the graduation pathway that they need.
We're talking with Carmen McCollum, who is covering education issues statewide as well as Northwest Indiana for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Carmen, thank you very much for being with us to talk today. And we look forward to the follow-up stories that you're talking about here, especially as all of the school superintendents and the school corporations learn more from what the state is doing here on changing the graduation rates.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Continuing on, let's check in with Joe Pete, who is a business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. How are you today, Joseph?
Oh, excellent, and happy to be here, Chris.
Well, I know that the last time that we talked about White Lodging Services was when the announcement had come out, and finally people could actually see some physical changes of what used to be the Radisson Hotel and the Star Plaza Theater. The theater's still standing, at least for now. We know the Radisson, though, has been torn down, and that's part and parcel of what's going to happen in the entire project in that particular corner of US 30 and I-65. But the latest development here is talking about some more business changes that White Lodging is making in their business model. Tell us about that.
Yes. The Star Plaza is the final show. Will be on the 10 days from now at the Oak Ridge Boys, and then that's curtains for that that longtime entertainment venue. But the company is it had been steadily growing basically since it was started by Bruce Wyatt in the 80s. However, now they're sharply reducing their portfolio. They're cutting nearly half the hotels they have under management. These are not hotels that they developed, but they're selling off about 82 of their suburban hotels to Interstate Hotels and Resorts. For an undisclosed sum. These are like Marriott's, Hilton, Hyatt hotels, kind of smaller ones between like 100 and 200 rooms all over the country. They're saying it's from Salt Lake City to West Palm Beach. Unfortunately, as part of this, they had laid off some of their employees at their corporate headquarters in Merrillville. There's less work to do with fewer properties under management. They're not saying how many. I've heard like it has been as much as like a quarter, but they're just saying it's a limited number, and they're not saying how many. The company is, however, growing. Part of the reason for this deal is that they're currently undergoing a pretty rapid national expansion. They've built 7 new hotels in the past year alone, and they expect to have another 18 up within the next 2 years. And part of the reason for this deal is that they're financing their own hotel development. These are just hotels that they manage. They're not ones that they had developed in the first place. They are also in like suburban areas, whereas the company generally is focusing more on like downtown hotels in bigger cities such as Chicago, Indy, Louisville, Denver, Austin. A lot of the hotels, they also have some luxury ranches they operate in Wyoming, but the company, they're generally focusing on these like nicer full-service hotels in downtown areas where some of them have like rooftop bars, that they have 8 of those that they're operating. They have restaurants. They're trying to fund that growth that they're doing nationally right now. They're adding like around 4,000 associates like nationwide as part of that growth, but they're kind of readjusting their portfolio and getting out of the suburban hotel business largely.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned since a lot of these were acquisitions that they must have made over the years, that has been any of impact with any of the acquisitions that they've made here in Northwest Indiana?
No, this is scattered all over. And these weren't hotels that they actually owned. They just had a contract to part of their business. It's a diversified company. They do different things like they're involved in all kinds of different projects, including, you know, restaurants and everything. But the main focus of the company is on developing and running hotels. That one of their businesses, though, is that they manage hotels where they just they don't own it, but they will operate it for, you know, oftentimes these hotels will be like a group of doctors or something will get together and be the investors and own it. And what they've offered is, you know, they'll run it for the owners. So these are just contracts that allow the new company to come in and take over kind of the day-to-day operations of these hotels. But these were not like assets that they they had no ownership stake in these hotels.
Well, it's like what you mentioned here. These were requests that were made by the people, the organizations that actually own the facilities. Like you mentioned, you may have a group of doctors that maybe for investment purposes find it's a good idea, but they realize, hey, we're doctors. We don't know how to run a hotel. And so as a result, they call on White Lodging to because we're the experts. They're the professionals. They know how to do this, and that's what they've done. So it just sounds like they've just trimmed things back a bit. It's not caused any real impact on White Lodging's revenue then, has it?
No, they're saying this is relatively minor. These account for about less than 25% of the revenue. These are kind of like the less profitable hotels. They're focusing more on trying to build all these new full-service hotels, which are hotels with like restaurants and other kind of amenities, or limited select service ones. But they're kind of just reorienting the kind of the markets they want to be in. And they're using this to fund the development of their own their own hotels. They'll have added about like 25 new hotels in 3 years that they'll own and operate themselves. So, but you know, you can't go on a building spree like that without, you know, funding it somehow.
Yeah.
And this is just the path they chose to take.
That's one way that you run a business, I suppose, to look at it that way. One of the other stories I know that you had recently, Joseph, here talks again about our Northwest Indiana steel industry. And in some respects, it was, I guess, the latest report here on how much the steel makers are really putting out these days and how we still have an overcapacity, don't we?
Yes, there was a big report that people have been waiting on for some time about the global steel overcapacity. It reached a record 637 million tons in 2016. There have been some moves by China and others to reduce it since then. But it's the world has far too much steelmaking capacity. It is largely as the result of new steel capacity that's come online with China. China is currently making 10 times as much steel as the United States. They, like most of their steel mills, are brand new. They make roughly half of all the steel in the world at this point. And it's been a problem for, you know, steelmakers throughout the world because it's heavily subsidized by their government. And then they're shipping it all over, like, below cost with the intention of putting these older, more established steel mills out of business. And then this report kind of confirms what, you know, the industry has been talking about now for some time, that this jeopardizes the very existence of companies across the world. This threatens jobs. It cuts into profitability. It depresses prices. They've talked about some of the toll. The Global Forum on Steel Excess Capacity was talking about the toll on just in America, where 33% of the steel making jobs have vanished over the last two decades alone, let alone from the peak like back in the 70s. And the production is down 43% nationally from the peak in 1973. They've been dealing with the flood of these cheap steel imports that are often illegally subsidized and, you know, violate trade rules. But it's a constant battle. And the U.S. Department of Commerce just approved more tariffs yesterday against Vietnam, mm-hmm. of up to 266%. And part of it is that it's whack-a-mole because those tariffs are specifically targeting steel that was being rerouted from China through Vietnam to come to America because we had slapped tariffs of up to like 300% on Chinese steel. So then as soon as that happens, we were importing like $2 million worth of Vietnamese steel. And then the next year, we're suddenly importing over $80 million worth of, Vietnamese corrosion-resistant steel. And it's China is just sending it over for finishing in Vietnam, and then it's being sent over here, and it's slowly eroding, the business that supports our mills along the lakefront and across the country.
Now, do you think that this latest report is going to have any impact as far as what Congressman Pete Visconti and the other members of his caucus that are railing against the overproduction of steel will have to say? Will it give them more ammunition to go to the White House and say, see, we told you so, that this is why we feel that these tariffs should not only continue on but be increased?
Absolutely. The industry has been already using this. They've been citing it. There's the big – the administration launched the big Section 232 investigation, to whether, these imports of steel are threatening national security. The thinking is that you need to have a robust domestic steel industry, because if you ever were to go to war, you're going to need to build warships, you're going to need to build tanks, you're going to need steel and tons of military applications. Like, any time an aircraft carrier is built, like, half the steel comes from Burns Harbor. Mm-hmm. Like, they make the plate for it. And the idea is that, if you're at war and you're importing all your steel that you need for munitions and so forth, that puts you at a serious disadvantage. And that's why they're looking at more draconian measures than just the tariffs they've imposed, which could include like quotas. They could cap the amount of steel that comes in. They could put more serious tariffs. They could block countries' steel from certain countries, such as China, altogether, to where they're not allowed to send anything here. That's what they've been investigating, and the steel industry and the United Steelworkers Union cite the report as saying, it's great that they put together this 52-page report. However, what we really need is action, and this is more evidence that action is needed because, it was collaboration of governments across the globe that kind of put this together, but there are no real action points like X, Y, and Z should be done, but they're citing it as evidence that the U.S. government needs to really step in and do more. The USW put out a statement saying, this is just another sign that political leaders are fiddling while Rome burns.
I see. And we're talking, by the way, with Joseph Pete, who covers business news that affect Northwest Indiana and the world for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Joseph, the latest story you have, tell us about another recall from Ford Motor Company, only unfortunately this time it's vehicles that are made here in the region. Tell us about that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's a pretty massive recall. Recalls have become like increasingly common in recent years just for liability reasons. but they are now recalling more than 200,000 Ford F-150s and the Ford Explorers that are made just across the state line in Hagewisch at the Chicago Assembly Plant on the banks of the Calumet River. And they are, there have been no injuries or accidents reported with it. It is, the front seat adjuster has been coming loose, but, you know, they take every precaution with these types of things to prevent anything. And they're encouraging people to bring infected vehicles into the dealership for free fixes. It's been, there have been actually a kind of number of recalls out of the plant in recent years. The most, significant one is probably with the police interceptor utilities and the police interceptor sedans. There have been issues where there have been emissions have been getting into the vehicles to where, like, there have been concerns that officers could, you know, pass out from carbon in there. They say it's as a result of aftermarket modifications that are done where mm-hmm. they have to drill holes in the back, you know, so they can, like, load up all their equipment and everything. And they're saying it's been caused by that. But that's, you know, potentially serious because that's a huge – they have a lock. It's basically the police interceptor utilities replaced the Crown Vic right. as a universal police car. And that's a big and significant business for them and steady. And they, you know, they have, like, three-fourths of the market share currently. But if they develop a bad reputation among police departments as, you know, this is putting officers at risk because there's carbon monoxide exposure, you know, that could potentially jeopardize that that chunk of business, so that, you know, they need to take every precaution to prevent these types of mass recalls.
Right.
But in this case, it's just they're sending people to the mechanics to get a pivot bolt. It'll either be replaced or it will be, improved and restored. It's basically that. It's just basically a safety recall where they're telling everybody, you know, if you're driving a 2016 Explorer that was made at the Chicago Assembly Plant last year, take it into your dealership and we'll fix it up for you.
A lot of these just means more business for the mechanics, I suppose, and they probably recognize that it's something that's necessary. They appreciate the business, to be sure, but they probably say, I wish this would be gone right at the factory the first time. We wouldn't be getting these in, but these things happen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, there was that big Toyota one a few years ago, and that kind of prompted to where now they'll recall for everything
mm-hmm.
just to avoid like a flood of litigation.
Well, it's understandable, too, especially when you're talking about, you mentioned about the fact with the Ford replacing the Crown Victoria vehicles, and we have the new police vehicles that are out there. And a problem like that, when you're talking about fumes and the like, it's a very serious concern that they want to get addressed right away. You can understand that, to be sure. And this is serious to a point, but as you say, there have been no accidents that we, as far as we know, that have reportedly happened because of the problems with the power seats.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But it's just something they need to stay on top of, because they are a major employer in the area. They have 5,000 jobs between here and the stamping plant, and then all those Lear seat assembly jobs and contract services, auto supplier jobs in Hammond are fueling that new massive new factory they're going to build across from the South Shore Line Station in mm-hmm. East Chicago. So they have a very significant impact, and it's just important that they. Are putting out these vehicles safely and maintaining the customer's trust. And, you know, because the amount they sell and produce directly affects the amount of employment here, because the auto industry is notorious for, when sales are down, they'll, cancel a shift and all of a sudden,
right.
1,300 people are out of work for, who knows how long. These are very good paying jobs. These are very good paying union jobs with top-notch benefits. They're extremely competitive to get these jobs. People, like, the backlog at the union hall to get hired is pretty significant.
For sure. There's always, of course, the economic impact overall, too, that if you have to lay off a number of people for whatever reason, that has an impact on a lot of other jobs and a lot of other businesses in the region as well, too. You're very concerned about that, too. So Joseph Peet covers business news for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joseph, thank you for being with us here to talk about your program today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's continue on with the stories here in Northwest Indiana, written and aired in some cases by the reporters who put them together for online as well as in print. And we have with us Andrew Steele, who's a reporter covering mostly business news and related topics for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Andrew, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, a lot of what I know that you have covered, it's been in the papers and online lately, have dealt with the casinos. Let's start out first here with some of the latest news from the casinos here in Northwest Indiana. Tell us, if you will, first here about how the improvements have been coming about here in particular, and the changes in ownership here with some of the casinos that are being proposed.
Well, yeah, I mean, during the 20 years that we've had casinos in Indiana, all of them have had some ownership change in some degree of ownership change in Northwest Indiana. The most recent thing is a possibility of Ameristar's owner, Pinnacle Entertainment, mm-hmm. essentially being purchased by a Penn Gaming company, which would combine those two companies.
Well, tell us a little bit about what you learned about Penn Gaming. I think that's a player I know that has been active and is active in other parts of Indiana and other states as well, too, but not familiar up here in the region.
Yeah, they do have the Hollywood Casino, so if you go over to Illinois, mm-hmm. There are a couple over there. And then there's one Hollywood Casino down south. They're a larger regional player than Pinnacle. But they're both comparable in what they do and what they offer. There are regulatory challenges all the time when casino companies change ownership or merge. One thing that they'll face in Indiana is that there's a limit of two casino licenses for any one company, mm-hmm. one owner. So if the two companies combined, that would be three casinos in Indiana. And so there would have to be some would have to give there.
Mm-hmm. And what did the folks there at Ameristar tell you about the possibility of this, and if they're excited about the change in ownership?
Well, I think it's very much still in the talking stages, and I have not talked to anyone at Ameristar. The people at Pinnacle who have investor conference calls and things periodically have also not been talked a lot about that specifically. Mm-hmm. They have talked about growing their company. The possibility of purchasing others. This would be kind of the opposite, the company would be purchasing them, but they definitely look at their situation as a company as being very solid right now in terms of their cash flow and their financial position, and so growth has definitely been on their radar, mm-hmm. one kind or another.
I know in a related story, in fact, you spent an entire story talking about this, and we've talked about this, I guess, off and on in the past about the importance for the casinos to try to find ways to not only keep the players coming in the front door, but bringing in new players, new participants in the gaming experience. And you spent time writing, telling our readers about this. Tell us a little bit about what you found out.
Yeah, and the big challenge would be getting younger players in, the millennial generation. And the casinos are very good about knowing who their customers are and knowing who their customers are not and who mm-hmm. and what they need to do. Right now, in a lot of ways, they focus for the future on trying to make the experience more social. So you have the image of someone sitting at a slot machine kind of isolated, or even at a blackjack table or something by themselves, or with a group they don't know. Mm-hmm. And what they're looking at is, how do you get more interaction among players, and that the younger people are interested in going out and spending time together, interacting with each other. Obviously video games are popular. How do you get more of a video game type of experience at the casinos? Is that possible to do?
And the people that you've talked to for the article, not only are you looking for more players and new players if they possibly can. They're concerned about, of course, they won't necessarily say so, I'm sure, about the other competition in the market. But how are the people that you've talked to felt about the soon to be competition coming out of the tribe in the South Bend area?
Yeah, I mean it will clearly have an impact, especially the further you go east. So Blue mm-hmm. Chip obviously might be impacted more. What they say, their company says, look, we're just going to keep doing what we do. We're going to keep offering the experience, the full experience that we offer, and just kind of see what happens. Right now, the South Bend Casino is being built as one that has slot machine type games only. So a lot of the growth in Northwest Indiana has been at table games, so I'm sure they'll continue to try with that. Also, just the experiences, the restaurants, there's a great hotel in mm-hmm. Michigan City, so that they'll try to continue that.
Continue to work at it, I suppose. We're talking with Andrew Steele, who's a reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, here on Reporters Roundtable Thursday. One of the other stories I know that you worked on, since you cover transportation issues on a regular basis, is about the infrastructure. We know that the state lawmakers last legislative session went ahead and granted a tax increase on the gasoline tax to pay for the infrastructure improvements that are needed. And I guess there's a good chunk of that, what, about a billion plus coming into Northwest Indiana over time.
Well, yeah, and I hit a story, a billion plus total, and now I was including rail projects in that too. South Shore is a huge part of that. But yeah, I mean, a couple hundred million in just the three county area in the next 5 years in roads and bridges. And a lot of that is financed by the gas tax. Some of it is projects that were planned already, but there's going to be an infusion of cash and projects into the region.
Were there any road projects in particular? I know it's a little early because the NDOT will do a lot of this in picking up what projects they decide to get started here in the LaPorte District. But I'm sure there are probably some major highways that they want to get some work done on pretty soon, don't they?
Yeah. You know, the Borman project, thankfully, is essentially wrapping up. But mm-hmm. I-65 widening to three lanes and continuing with some of the concrete rehab south of Merrillville is a big one. There are other state highways throughout all three counties and in the entire LaPorte District.
Right.
Just a big map of projects.
Also, you talked to me. You mentioned about the fact that a lot of the work that's being proposed for the South Shore Line is part of the overall infrastructure project too. As is some work at the Gary Chicago International Airport too. And your story, I know, talks about that in some detail too.
Yeah, at the airport, and just recently, the fixed base operators—they're the ones who provide service, maintenance, and other services to. Private flyers, private clients. They both have had some pretty big infrastructure mm-hmm. openings recently. The Gary Jet Center opened a new corporate terminal, I think it was about a $3 million project, which is just a really great facility for their customers. And then just recently, B. Coleman opened a new 40,000 square foot hangar, $5 million project. And they're talking about absorbing more business from Chicago.
Yeah, and I know that and you mentioned some of that in your story as well, too, that the Gary Chicago International Airport has been working very hard to attract more private aviation customers from some of the other airports in the area, in Chicago in particular, because they know it's very congested over in the Chicago area, and they want to try to attract them to come over here and put their planes up for hangar space and things like that here.
Yeah, and what they said... you know, is that hangars are filling up in Midway. And so it's not just mm-hmm. that there's a lot of the commercial traffic, but the private flyers that don't have the as much hangar space. And then they say when they come to Gary, they really find it to be so much more convenient because of the busyness at Chicago airports. Mm-hmm. And it's just very easy to get in and out. And it's very easy to get in and out of downtown Chicago. And in fact, it's probably easier to get from Gary to downtown than from Midway to downtown, just the way the roads work.
And speaking of the airport in Gary, so there's a continuing project that's underway that's just been announced here lately. That's under work right now is the plan to set up the Customs and Borderland Security facility there at the airport too.
Yeah, and what that will do is allow them to accept incoming international flights, which they cannot do now. And what they say they get requests all the time or comments all the time from people who would want to do that. And they can't right now. You know, you can land in, there are people who land in Midway to go through customs and then hop over to Gary. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, once they do this, it should be June or so that this opens up. They have all the approvals. You have to work very closely with customs and border protection and the design of the buildings and things like that. But they're ready to go on that. So.
Now, where is this facility going to go in there at the Gary Airport?
There's kind of a shell building that's attached to the fire station they have there. Mm-hmm. And it's really an undeveloped building, kind of empty right now. And so they're going to put it in there. It's right next to the terminal, right next to Gary Jet Center property. So it's right in the middle of things. Right there.
Very convenient location to put in a new facility like this.
They had a building existing, so they don't have to build completely new.
Andrew Steele covers transportation as well as some of the other business-related issues for the Times of Northwest Indiana, and he's been with us to talk about these stories that have shown up in print and online, too. Andrew, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Recently Speaking for today and for this week. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us. And thanks always to the reporters who have contributed this week to our Reporters Roundtable. And they include, from the Times, Mark Chase, Carmen McCullum, Joseph Pete, and Andrew Steele. And we hope you'll join us on Monday for another Regionally Speaking.